Hi everyone, and welcome to the Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. My name is Madeline Pepper, and I am a first-year law student here at the Queen's Faculty of Law, and I'm your host today. Queen's Pro Bono Radio discusses interesting and off-center legal topics to make legal discussions more accessible to you. At the Pro Bono Radio, we want to stimulate interest in legal topics by providing information that is entertaining. This podcast is not legal advice, and if you are looking for advice, please consult a lawyer. Today, I'm going to be discussing the topic of plea bargains and whether plea bargains threaten the presumption of innocence in the Canadian justice system. To give you some context, the presumption of innocence is a fundamental principle of our criminal justice system. Protected by charter rights under Section 11D, any person charged with an offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty according to the law in a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal. On paper, this appears straightforward and enforceable, but in an imperfect justice system, where there's court backlogs and delays, disproportionate access to justice, and a lack of resources, how feasible is this principle really? In comes plea bargains, the apparent solution to our imperfect criminal justice system. A plea bargain is a legal agreement between the prosecution and defense counsel in criminal proceedings, where the accused may get some form of benefit, often in the form of a reduced sentence or a lesser charge, in exchange for a guilty plea, though judges always have the final say on sentencing. Don't get me wrong, plea bargains play a critical role in addressing the imperfections of our criminal justice system, and are used in situations where conviction for the accused is likely. Plea bargains help mitigate backlog in the court system by resolving cases without the need for a full trial. They offer a resolution to the enormous expenses that come with a criminal trial, including court and legal fees, that disproportionately burden marginalized communities. Plea bargains provide a level of certainty for criminal proceedings and accused persons. When outcomes of trial can be so uncertain, these reassure parties that like cases will be treated alike. Administrative reasons aside, plea bargains encourage accountability from an accused person, giving victims a sense of closure and potentially avoiding the stressful experience of testifying in court. There's no doubt that plea bargains are incredibly important, not only for the efficiency of our criminal justice system, but also its effectiveness. Plea bargains help resolve administrative inefficiencies while also providing victims and accused persons levels of certainty in the system. With all the benefits of plea bargains, there are limitations. What happens in the case when an accused person, who is innocent but has a likely chance of conviction, is faced with a plea bargain? Let's revisit the presumption of innocence for a moment. This principle is built upon the notion that the dismissal of a guilty person is better than the conviction of an innocent one. Although we want to trust that the system gets this right every time, there has been times in which it hasn't, and this has led to a wrongful conviction. A wrongful conviction occurs when an individual is found guilty for a crime they did not commit. Wrongful convictions can occur for a multitude of reasons, particularly evidentiary issues, with false eyewitness testimony as a leading cause of wrongful convictions, bias and prejudice, inadequate defense counsel, or prosecutorial misconduct, and notably, false guilty pleas. False guilty pleas can occur when vulnerable accused confess to crimes they did not commit due to the evidence against them, a lack of resources, and pressure from authorities. The guilty plea of an innocent person who has a likelihood of conviction cannot be understood as an effective and efficient use of the justice system, but rather their only option. Though plea bargains resolve inefficiencies in our justice system, when looked at through the perspective of wrongful convictions, do they also have the potential to override the fundamental principle of the presumption of innocence? A plea bargain can eliminate an individual's right to be presumed innocent until proven guilty by an independent and impartial tribunal. An accused maintains the right to a trial, even when offered a plea bargain, but once an accused pleads guilty, they waive their right to a trial. An innocent person who faces a harsh sentence, a family to support at home, and evidence against them, are they really given a choice? Before I explore cases of plea bargains that led to wrongful convictions, let's explore current legislation on plea bargains that try and regulate the practice. The law requires that an accused admits their guilt before the court accepts a plea, and what is considered a valid guilty plea can be found under Section 606 of the Criminal Code. Under Section 606.1.1, a valid guilty plea is one where the facts support the charge, the accused has made the plea voluntarily, and the accused understands that the plea is an admission of the essential elements of the offense. This is both the act and fault elements. As well, they understand the nature and consequences of the plea. Section 606 also requires that a judge inform the defendant that they are not bound to the sentencing recommendation. You would hope that this legislation reinforces that all guilty pleas are truthful, though when faced with insufficient resources, bias, tunnel vision, and legal advice, these requirements are not always fairly applied to accused persons. With a better understanding of the law around plea bargains, let's explore the challenges with this legislation and how false guilty pleas can come about. So firstly, let's discuss the role of evidence and how evidence can play a significant role in false guilty pleas. Something that a wrongfully accused person hopes to wholeheartedly rely on is the use of evidence in dismissing a charge. Whether it's physical evidence, expert testimony, or eyewitness testimony, evidence can sometimes be the most influential factor in establishing or dismissing a charge, especially in front of a jury. Eyewitness testimony is a leading cause of wrongful convictions. Whether it be memory issues, prejudice against the accused and tunnel vision, or stress and trauma, eyewitness testimonies have repeatedly contributed to miscarriages of justice. When a jury is faced with a distressed victim or witness who identifies an accused with confidence, it can be a compelling factor in a conviction. In addition to eyewitness testimony, expert testimony has played a significant role in wrongful convictions in the past. Notoriously, disgraced ex-pathologist Charles Smith, who was the head forensic pathologist at SickKids from 1982 to 2003. Smith's questionable medical conclusions led to 13 convictions, 5 of which were found wrongful. Smith lacked the requisite training and qualifications to work in this field, and vulnerable accused persons suffered the consequences. Although we hope that the criminal justice system today is not tainted with the inadequate expert testimony, the situation around Charles Smith shows the weight that evidence, especially from a trusted, authoritative figure, can have on convictions. Moving on, insufficient resources also play a significant role in false guilty pleas. Whether it's an inability to finance a criminal proceeding, inadequate access to legal services, or the need to support one's family, when someone is faced with the likelihood of conviction and a harsher sentence, a vulnerable, wrongfully accused may believe their best option is to plead guilty to receive a lesser sentence or a lesser charge. A lack of resources accompanied by inadequate counsel can leave a wrongfully accused with a lack of choices or a lack in understanding their choices, such as the fact that they are not bound to a sentencing agreement and they do maintain a right to trial. Systemic discrimination is another factor that contributes to false guilty pleas, and it's important to note that marginalized communities are especially vulnerable to false guilty pleas. Minorities may experience racial or gender bias from witnesses and authorities, as well accused persons who are part of low socioeconomic groups are disproportionately burdened by costs associated with criminal proceedings. Recognizing how the criminal justice system works against marginalized communities is important in understanding the dilemma that a wrongfully accused person may experience when faced with a plea bargain. Finally, pressure from the justice system plays a large role in false guilty pleas. When someone's faced with compelling evidence, a lack of resources, they will often face pressure from the justice system to accept plea bargains. The defense counsel and prosecution may strongly believe that a jury will find the accused guilty, and the accused may be advised to accept a plea bargain instead of face the uncertainties of a trial by jury or judge. In examining the various ways in which false guilty pleas come about, it raises some concerns on legislation around guilty pleas. Can a guilty plea really be deemed valid or voluntary when it is made under conditions involving compelling evidence, a lack of financial resources, and systemic discrimination, giving an accused no other option? I'm going to explore a few cases in which false guilty pleas have led to wrongful convictions, and how these illustrate how the circumstances of an individual can refute their right to the presumption of innocence. Firstly, I'm going to discuss the case of Dinesh Kumar. Dinesh Kumar was wrongfully convicted of criminal negligence causing death of his son Gaurav. One night in February 1992, Gaurav had stopped breathing and as a result suffered irreversible brain damage that placed him on life support, and he passed away later that month. Mr. Kumar had become a subject of interest due to the evidence against him. Firstly, disgraced ex-pathologist Charles Smith, who at the time of Mr. Kumar's charge had a stellar reputation, concluded that Gaurav had died from shaken baby syndrome. In addition to the expert testimony of Smith, Mr. Kumar's first son, Sarab, had experienced an episode of asphyxiation in the past where he had to be revived by CPR. At the time, Children's Aid suspected that Mr. Kumar had caused the incident. Faced with the charge of second-degree murder, Mr. Kumar was offered a plea bargain. In exchange for a guilty plea to a lesser charge of criminal negligence causing death, Dinesh would face a reduced sentence of 90 days imprisonment served on weekends, with 2 years probation, and a promise for authorities not to report the incident to immigration officials. Dinesh Kumar was a new immigrant to Canada from India. He was the sole financial support for his family, and he was facing a harsh sentence of second-degree murder, as well as compelling evidence against him supporting this charge. He accepted the agreement and pled guilty to the lesser offense. The downfall of Charles Smith reopened Dinesh Kumar's case, where the Ontario Court of Appeal set aside Dinesh's guilty plea and acquitted him. Dinesh Kumar's guilty plea appeared voluntary. It appeared he understood he was admitting to the elements of the offense, that he understood the consequences, and the false evidence against him certainly supported the charge. But can a guilty plea really be categorized as voluntary when a vulnerable accused, in this case a vulnerable wrongfully accused, virtually had no other alternative? Dinesh Kumar's legal counsel advised him that he had no challenge against the testimony of Charles Smith. He was the primary support system for his family, and a lengthy prison sentence for second-degree murder would significantly damage their lives. And as an immigrant, he risked facing deportation. The case of Dinesh Kumar outlines how evidence, discrimination, inadequate resources, and pressure from the justice system can result in false guilty pleas. The Ontario Court of Appeal found that Kumar's guilty plea met the traditional tests for a valid guilty plea under Section 606.1.1 of the Criminal Code, though the circumstances that led to his plea were unjust. He faced a loss of liberty, losing custody of his child, and deportation. Dinesh Kumar faced a dilemma, and as a result, he was not afforded the right of the presumption of innocence. I will now explore the case of Anthony Hainmayer, who was wrongfully convicted of break and enter and assault in 1987 due to a false guilty plea based upon eyewitness testimony. The mother of the victim, a 15-year-old girl, had encountered the assailant breaking into her daughter's room one night. She described the assailant as blonde, blue eyes, small ears, and a baby face, a description that matched Hainmayer, who she, through her own investigation, discovered worked for a construction company doing work in the area. Despite the fact that Hainmayer had quit his job 5 days prior to the assault, she identified Hainmayer in a photo lineup and he was arrested. For much of the criminal proceedings, Mr. Hainmayer maintained his innocence and did not accept any plea agreements from the Crown. Though at trial, the victim's mother confidently identified Hainmayer as the assailant. Faced with compelling eyewitness testimony, which had a strong likelihood of conviction and an expected 6 to 10 years imprisonment if convicted, Hainmayer finally accepted a plea deal, and he received a sentence of 2 years. Lawyers from Innocence Canada, James Lockyer and Joanne McLean, discovered that Paul Bernardo had confessed to the crime that Hainmayer was convicted of in 2006. This was after Hainmayer's conviction, and he had already served his time and was now released. While Hainmayer was released, no authorities had divulged this information to him to acquit him of this criminal charge on his record. Innocence Canada took on Mr. Hainmayer's case, where he was eventually acquitted. In Mr. Hainmayer's appeal, the Ontario Court of Appeal reiterated that a valid guilty plea must be voluntary, unequivocal, and informed, and that his conviction did not meet these requirements. Although he came to his own decision to plead guilty and understood the nature of his charges and the consequences of his plea, he was faced with a dilemma: a minimum of 6 years in prison and a very compelling eyewitness testimony. Anthony Hainmayer was denied the presumption of innocence. From the cases I've discussed, it becomes more apparent how plea bargains come about. In the case of a guilty accused person, plea bargains simply streamline criminal proceedings. But can plea bargains be justified even if there's the slightest risk of imprisoning a wrongfully accused and denying them this presumption of innocence? There's no doubt that plea bargains create a dilemma in our justice system. On one hand, plea bargains work to reconcile the imperfections of our system. They improve court backlogs, reduce carceral sentences, and make the system more consistent. They improve the overall efficiency and effectiveness of the system. On the other hand, plea bargains interfere with an individual's right to the presumption of innocence by obtaining a guilty plea before one can be tried before an impartial and independent tribunal. This becomes a significant issue, as we've discussed, when the accused is an innocent person. How can we reconcile the benefits of plea bargains with their challenges to ensure that no wrongfully accused are backed into this corner? An important consideration could be to try and limit the pressure placed upon an accused person. Many accused, such as in the cases of Dinesh Kumar and Anthony Hainmayer, accept a plea bargain for fear of receiving a harsher sentence. Placing this pressure upon an accused person overlooks the possibility that the Crown may not be able to prove all elements of their offense beyond a reasonable doubt, and even upon conviction, ignores the ability for a sentencing judge to consider all details of the case and sentence offenders proportionally. Due to the important role of plea bargains in the criminal justice system, we can look to potential administrative changes that can help reform the procedure without undermining its efficiency. The Crown holds the power in plea negotiations, so many suggestions surround the role of the prosecutor in coming to a plea bargain. For example, an article in the Manitoba Law Journal refers to a German model which requires prosecutors to record all stages of the plea bargaining process. Whether this is in writing or orally, they are required to note information such as which party suggested the negotiations take place, the facts forming the basis of the decision, and the contributions from each party. The goal of this suggestion is to have the plea bargaining process reviewed, accepted, rejected, or reformulated by a judge to reduce potential oversights and maintain procedural safeguards. The goal in plea bargain reform is to enhance the transparency, accountability, and fairness, so no accused, whether wrongful or not, accepts agreements that are unjust. Overall, plea bargains are critical in our criminal justice system, and in many ways have positively contributed to its efficiency, consistency, and success. That's not to say plea bargains do not have any downfalls, especially when viewed through the lens of wrongful convictions, by threatening the presumption of innocence. Plea bargains create a dilemma, where the rights of an accused person are weighed against the needs of the justice system. Reconciling the two is not an easy feat, and it is not equally applied to all accused persons, especially those from vulnerable communities. Although plea bargains are essential to the functions of the justice system, the conviction of an innocent person in Canada is an utmost miscarriage of justice and can occur as a result of plea bargains, when an individual is not afforded the presumption to innocence. We'll have to wait and see what the future of plea bargaining may hold in our justice system, and what reforms, if any, may occur. Before I end the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, host, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of the PBSC Queen's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers, and they are not authorized to provide any legal advice. The podcast contains general discussions of certain legal and related issues. If you require legal advice, please consult a lawyer. Thank you for listening. Today's show was produced by your host, Madeline Pepper. If you liked this interview, you can find more on the Queen's Pro Bono Radio website.